We talked last week about the midrash of Avraham looking at the world, seeing the castle, and seeing the light on in the castle, and saying, if there is a castle, there must be a master who is home. Last week we did a different take on that midrash, but there are different takes on it. One take is, it's really, the rabbis are saying that Avraham looked at the world. Avraham was a truth seeker. He looked at the world and he started searching when he was 3 years old. And three-year-olds ask questions about, you know, where's Hashem? And at the age of 48, or some say 52, he came to his conclusion of the existence of God in the world. So, Einstein said that the miracle of the world is its sheer comprehensibility. In other words, in looking at the world, you get proof of the existence of God. So how is that? So I'm going to take a couple of approaches. The first one is the awe before creation. Okay? And this is pretty amazing. It's pretty mind-blowing. If you want to understand the size of our solar system, okay? In other words, the Earth compared to the Sun, and from the Earth to the Sun is only about, I don't know what, is only like a fifth of our solar system. So if the Earth was a grain of sand, okay? No, sorry, if the Earth was a marble, the Earth was a marble put on the end zone, right? 0 yard line. The Sun would be a beach ball on the 100 yard line, okay? If the Earth was a marble on the end zone, the Sun would be a beach ball on the 100 yard line. So our solar system would go until, you know, I don't know, another 300-400 yards, okay? And the Earth was a marble. Okay. That's the first step of understanding our solar system. Then you take, let's say our solar system was a baseball. Okay? Take that, you know, from the end zone to the 100-yard line, to the 300-yard line, put that into a baseball. Okay? If our solar system was a baseball, the galaxy we're in, the Milky Way galaxy, would be the North America. Okay? The galaxy is a couple of billion light years across. Okay? Remember, light travels at 172,000 miles a second. Okay? Figure that out in hours and years. And then you're talking about the universe being billions of light years large, the galaxy. And on top of that, so the galaxy is North America. There are billions of galaxies. Okay. So the vastness of the universe is beyond our ability to comprehend. You have to kind of reduce the solar system into a baseball, you know, and the Earth into a marble, you know. And just in front of the sheer size of the universe, we feel this sense of awe and of incredible just fascination, and feeling overwhelmed by the vastness of the universe and the greatness of God. That's the first way to look at the design proof. Now, there's another. When you start talking about the design proof in science, you have to address a seeming contradiction between science and religion. Okay? And part of that contradiction was that until the 1900s, science basically understood the universe to be a static place. Everything was in place. The Greeks said it was hung there by a god who created it. And then it just stayed there and nothing moved. And it's always been and it always will be. Biblical view, of course, is creation, which would not be a static universe. It would be a universe which was put in place at a certain time and then was added to and is unfolding. And in 1922, there was a... actually, before that, Edwin Hubble, famous Hubble telescope, observed, first of all, that the universe was much larger than people thought, okay? You can, with the naked eye, you can see 4,000 stars. Okay? The rabbis already knew that there were billions of stars. How they knew that? interesting question. There are lots of, as a whole, it relates to the discussion of belief in God, because if we believe there is a God, and we believe that God gave us a Torah, wisdom coming from a higher source, then the fact that the Torah has within it secrets of the universe, which humanity only discovered 3,000 years later with modern science, that's also a basis for the existence of God. It also is a basis for seeing the truth of the Torah. But the rabbis knew, in the Talmud, it describes the billions of stars that exist. And it wasn't until Edwin Hubble built this telescope, which could see, you know, way beyond all the ones that existed before, that he came to that conclusion as well. And now science has, radio telescopes have validated it. So, but part of the problem is that Hubble also realized that the universe was not static. It was moving. Okay. And this refuted the belief which had existed for thousands of years. But the universe is moving. It's expanding. Okay. Now, in 1922, there was an astrologer, Friedman, who came to the conclusion that not only is the universe moving, it's expanding from one set spot. And in fact, his theory of the Big Bang answered serious questions Einstein had about his relativity theory explaining the universe. And Einstein actually at first was extremely skeptical of Hubble, saying that the universe is moving, until he went to the laboratory in California, looked at all his data, looked through the telescope, finally had to be convinced. Interestingly enough, the genius, when there was a theory that proved his outlook, and his outlook completely redefined our understanding of the physical world. Newtonian physics was thrown out the window. So even he was resistant to accepting this new idea. And it just shows, you know, you say, well, how could these brilliant scientists not accept certain implications of modern science? People are stuck in their outlooks. You know, even Einstein was. So Friedman concluded that not only the world was expanding, but it all started in a single point. Okay? And the term Big Bang was actually coined by Sir Fred Hoyle, that the universe started in one spot, exploded, and then is still flying at an incredibly fast rate out towards the limits of the universe. And what Penzias, who discovered this with them, said is, astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing and is delicately balanced to provide exactly the conditions required to support life. Now, the theory was that scientists said, well, so then how do you explain this? First moment and then explosion. What they say is that the universe exploded. The force of the explosion threw everything out, but what happens is eventually the force dissipates, and all of the matter of the universe, through gravitational pull, will start to redraw itself to each other. Eventually will re-implode till everything comes back to a single point, and what's going to happen after it all re-implodes into a single point? It's going to explode again. So science said there was no creation. The universe has just been exploding, expanding, contracting, and re-exploding throughout all eternity. So that was the explanation. Now, according to that, the universe is expanding but should be slowing down. And then the problem was that in 1978, first of all, they found Robert Jastrow, an astronomer, realized that there isn't enough matter in the universe to get it to re-implode. In other words, the gravitation pull is not enough to get it to stop and then to get it re-imploding. And the second problem was that the universe is not slowing down. If it's going to re-implode, it should slow down, and eventually it's not slowing down, it's still expanding. So it's going to go flying off for the rest of time. So that was an even bigger problem. And it caused them to conclude that in fact, that moment of Big Bang was the beginning of time and the beginning of existence as we know it. And so what he said was that He said this: "This is an extremely strange development, unexpected by all but the theologian. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." So science finally got to the truths of the universe, the Big Bang Theory. But then it led them to say, you know, that the world had to have started at one point at one time. Now, what's also wild about this is that this theory of the world starting at one point at one time and exploding and expanding was also presented by none other than Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, who was a medieval, one of the great medieval rabbis, lived slightly after Maimonides, medieval Spain, and he was known for his great erudition, for being a great rabbi and a Kabbalist. And in his commentary on Genesis, see those blue books over there? Open up to the beginning of Genesis, you will see a description of Big Bang Theory. He says, all of matter was not created over 6 days. It wasn't that on the fifth day God said, okay, let's make a cow. Boom, cow appears. All matter was in one spot at the first moment of creation, and the rest of the 6 days of creation were things being formed one from the other. He also says that all the matter was like in a mustard seed, and he says that it was made of two elements. And Big Bang Theory is everything was made, started with hydrogen and helium. So once again, not only has science come to the conclusion that the world has started at one point in one moment, and they don't know what existed before, if anything, what we call creation, something from nothing, yesh ma'ayin. And that discovery, validated by science, is found in our holy writings. How? Because Nachmanides was a Kabbalist, and the Kabbalah is the study of the secrets of creation. So, part of the looking at the world and seeing God in the world is understanding the conclusions of modern science, seeing how they correspond to a biblical outlook of creation, something from nothing. And not only that, but on top of it, we've known those secrets all along, which modern science has presented. The billions of stars and the Big Bang Theory. Okay? Questions? Is this all too abstract, esoteric, way out there? No? We're all okay? All right.
I need the baseball. I'm just saying the visual analogies are helpful.
Uh-huh. And the size of the universe. Okay. So, by the way, I didn't ask you at the beginning. Last week I asked you to try and write down in these four categories of design, divine providence, moral imperative, and experiential truths, your basis for belief. Did anyone write down the design, looking at nature, seeing God in the world? So what did you note about
this
that?
This summer we went to Bryce Canyon in Utah, as well as Zion National Park. And, I mean, if anyone has been there, I think you know what I mean. And if you haven't, like, just the rock structures there, mind-blowing. And then within...
Hold on. So, is it the beauty of it, or is it the complexity of it, or is
beauty,
it...
and the complexity, both. Because Bryce is gorgeous to just look at, but the complexity of it... I mean, there's obviously... I know the science behind it, just the erosion, and how there used to be water within Utah, but yet it's still, like...
gorges, you know, hundreds of feet deep, and the water, like, it's year just, after year.
Deep. Yeah. I mean, the thought of it, like, makes me immediately think, like, wow, you know, there had to be a designer amongst this.
Okay. Anyone else? Yeah. Stacy, right?
Yes. Yeah. I thought of, sometimes I'm on the subway, and I'm like, I'm not even kidding.
On the subway, yeah.
And I'm just like, it's really, like, impressive how, like, you do to get around. to myself, like, if man did this, like, where did the continents come from? Like, where did all these other things come from? Like, I just think, like, somebody had to, like, build these, like, things, connect these
things. So if there is a system, then there has to be a designer to the system. Okay. So we have two different outlooks here. The first one we're going to, interestingly enough, you know, seeing the beauty in nature, you could view it as the design proof, but you could also view it as the experiential truth. And I'm going to leave it for the experiential truth because I think the aesthetic reaction to nature is more of a experience of God than a understanding of God in the world. Okay? But so the whole question of design and complexity. So here again, you can look at nature and look at a DNA strand. Anyone know how many bits of information are on a DNA strand? What, a couple of billion? Okay. Now, not only are there a couple of billion bits, but because it's a helix, the bits of information, it's not just lined up, it's how they're juxtaposed one to another as well. So the, you know, interconnection relations between them are mind-blowing. Okay? The human brain. I forget that, you know, they calculated how many synapses you have and, you know, how many, within each synapse, how many electrical impulses are going. We, you know, with all our supercomputers and our internet, we still haven't created a computer which can do what the mind can do. Okay. Now, with that said, I, over the last few days, I had long discussions with a friend of mine who is a scientific, he's a PhD, MD, PhD. His research is, I think, in cancer research, but he's a brilliant biologist, chemist, physicist. He knows all of science. I think the guy's close to being brilliant. And he's an observant Jew, a Baal Tshuva. And I had long discussions about this question of the design proof. In other words, the way we have an intuitive understanding, the way the world works is it goes from order to randomness, right? If you just let things be, what's going to happen? The leaves on the tree are going to get scattered, right? The building's going to disintegrate. You drop something, the beads are going to spread all over. The glass is going to break and shatter into a million pieces, right? When things are just left, or if there are reactions, cause and effect, things go from order to disorder. So, of course, the question is, your sense, Stacey's saying, we live in a world where there's all such order. You know, that's what Einstein is saying, and the comprehensibility of just looking at nature. So, however, there is an alternative explanation. Okay, what is the alternative explanation? Evolution. Okay. And the way evolution works is that natural selection is the things that work best are the things that will stick around. And then what happens is in the natural world and in the molecular world, in the world of DNA, you have mutations. You have variation that occurs on its own. And it's a theory of transfer of information. Even in a computer, whenever information is transferred, mistakes crop in. Even the best computer. All right? You guys, what do they call them? Glitches. Virus is caused, but you get glitches, right? So when that transfer is done, and the information changes, it creates variation. All these variations being created, the ones that work best stick around. And so you will have different elements evolving to more complexity. Now, they also sometimes, because of that, they will order themselves in ways towards the things that work. Okay? So if there's a variation and then it works and it's more ordered, then greater order can come into the universe. That's the basis for the theory of evolution. We don't have time to get into the whole discussion of it, but he actually said to me, he believes, that the order and complexity of the universe itself you can explain through evolution on a molecular level and on a natural science level. And by the way, science and Torah are not contradictory. You can believe in the Torah and you can believe in the conclusions of modern science as well. And Maimonides said, if something is truth, it's truth. And you have the truth of the Torah, and you have the truth of science, the two must be able to correspond. Now, if they don't correspond, it's one of two possibilities. Either the science is not accurate, and science does change every 50 years, decade, sometimes every 10 years, or you're not understanding the Torah correctly. And you know there's a whole debate about what, when Torah says the world's created in 7 days, what were the 7 days before the sun was created? Was it 24 hours? There are even other ways to understand that maybe it wasn't 7 24-hour days. Okay? So, as I said, maybe you're not understanding the Torah correctly. You know, if creationists, if fundamental Christians say, well, you know, you can't believe in science because the Bible says the world was created in 7 days, that's not our approach. Like, somewhere you have to understand either they correspond or they don't and why they don't. Yeah.
Well, I understand what you're saying, that, you know, why, you know, doctors and scientists who are willing to choose, I don't get how you can believe in evolution.
If you look at the order of the story of creation, what does it start with? Light, water, then the most basic element, beings, insects, and fish, then birds, then reptiles, starting to go on the land, then crawling animals, then animals. If you look at the order of the story of creation, what do you see? The order of evolution. Not only can how you believe it, the Torah presents that order. Now, do you believe that the evolution came through random circumstances of mutations that happened to, and there's also people try to refute evolution by saying, well, how could the wing of a fly evolve? Because if the fly, some fly blew with the mutation of a wing, it wouldn't have been big enough to fly. It had to then mutate more and become bigger. And so it couldn't have been the fly to survive because it flew, because the mutation had to occur first. Like, which came first, the chicken? Let me give you another example. The venom of a snake that bites. So how does a snake bite a venomous snake? It has holes in its teeth. So which came first, the holes or the venom? Well, how could the holes evolve in the teeth if the venom couldn't get through to begin with? So there's some people who want to say that there are these contradictions. I want to kind of put these debates about evolution aside. But what we can say is come back to Einstein's conclusion, which is, forget even the explanation of, you know, somebody would say, well, if you can't explain how the physical world got here, then say, well, God put it here. And there's some validity. God is the next best argument to explain how it got here. But that doesn't really prove it. Because maybe there's another explanation we just don't know. But what you can say is that if you look at the systems in the universe, okay, not the complexity of the design, but just the fact that we have laws of physics and laws of nature and laws of chemistry, how did those laws get implemented in the world to begin with? And that's what Einstein's saying. The miracle of the world is its sheer comprehensibility. In other words, that there are laws that work according to systems is in itself a testimony to existence. That's what he said. And it's called, and not only are there laws, but it's called fine-tuned universe theory. If the Earth was a fraction of a percentage closer to the sun, we would be fried. And if it was a fraction of a percentage away from the sun, we would be frozen.
Can you repeat that?
Sorry?
Can you repeat that?
if the world were a fraction of a percentage closer to the sun, we would be fried. And if it was a fraction of further away from the sun, we would be frozen. And that's why there's no other life in the solar system or the universe that we know of yet.
I can't say both those cons.
No, this is a fine-tuned theory of the universe. That everything, you know, gravity works in the right way, and the Earth is poised at the right place, and the you know, physics gives us systems in the world. Yeah.
You said we haven't found life in our universe yet. You said that, you know, for a long time people thought there were 4,000 stars. Tom would always knew that there was more. Is Tom the same thing about life outside of Earth?
So it's a very interesting question. The rabbis in the 1600s were debating this question. Okay. You know, talk about the progressive thinking of the Torah, you know. And they come out on both sides. And then the question is, well, this is a question of what is the definition of life. And actually, according to science, the definition of life is what DNA does. It's that, in a sense, DNA is a chemical structure which stores information. That's what it is. And that's how they define life. So as far as they know, there aren't any other of those. And then from a Jewish point of view, it's not, are there any other, what we call vegetative life, as opposed to inanimate minerals, which don't have embedded within them the ability to re-perpetuate themselves, like and the plant life does in the plant world. Okay? Mineral world just rearranges itself, doesn't it? So it's not only that that you have embedded within the world this vegetative life and then animal life, but it's the question is there other life that has free will in relationship to God? That would be the question. Are there other beings that have free will? That there are other plants and some other planets. So okay, so what? It's just another, you have another rock, you have another plant. But the question is, now they think if you have other vegetative life, maybe you will have other advanced life with free will as well. So that's a speculation. But you can read the article by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. It's in the Aryeh Kaplan Reader, which is different than the Aryeh Kaplan Anthology. By the way, anything by Aryeh Kaplan is amazing.
I tried to read one.
Do you remember what the book was?
Yeah, I don't remember what it was called offhand, but it was about being able to, I can't do it right now, but like focus your beliefs. It was on, a lot about meditation. I think the book was something about
Jewish meditation or meditation and Kabbalah?
No, Jewish
meditation.
And people were like, it was supposed to be like an easy read to try reading a few times. Like,
so if you're into meditation, you might understand it. It's not a simple book on meditation, even though it's supposed to be. There's a simpler book called Everyday Kabbalah by Mindy Ribner, and it is a guide to, she gives you actual, like a guided meditation starting from ground zero. Okay, if that's what you're looking for. But let's get back to the design proof. So the conclusion of the design proof would be that just even the fact that the world has not even the design, but it has systems that work in such a structured way, almost like you were saying, Stacy, about, you know, like the subway, all hubs all interconnecting, and the subways don't, you know, the tracks, and they don't collide, and everything's timed. So the fact that we have systems in the universe set up like that would be an argument to say that there is a design in the universe. Okay? So that's the design proof. Is there another question?
I just had a clarifying question. So you said earlier that Judaism is like the
Israel. You could have an understanding of the Torah that could include evolution. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So then the idea then is that what even started that theory in the first place?
Right. In other words, why is there even laws of physics? Okay. Mm-hmm. They didn't evolve out of something else in the natural world. They don't. The laws of physics, the structures of the universe, don't evolve one out of the other. They're in place. Yes.
So I understand how that works together, but when I went to the Galapagos with my family, it was five Jewish families, and this like scientist showing us around all the different islands, and every single, you know,
it only exists there because of this, because of that. And so how do you explain, I mean, how is that?
Well, I'm saying evolution is not contrary to the Torah. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Because I always thought that, I was under the belief that Darwin, like all that stuff in the Galapagos, was so, I didn't know how to like understand that.
Well, we're saying that it's not contradictory. No. Because Nachmanides says that all the matter was created at the first instant of creation. That's what we call creation, yesh ma'ayan, something from nothing. That was all the matter of the universe was created into one concentrated point. Now, because it came from nothing, it couldn't sustain itself, because all of a sudden it was there in time and space, and it exploded because of it couldn't be contained. And because it came from God, from another dimension. Right. So once you're saying that all the matter was put in the world in the first instant, and then the rest of the 7 days are just rearranging it in different forms.
In order. So that would explain why their animals would be living here.
But you'd say that God created certain structures, physical and chemical principles in the world that allow it to go towards order.
The fact that the mutations would be inherited over so many generations.
Well, the mutations, right. The mutations, and then the ones that are beneficial are the ones that survive.
Yeah, but mutations are probably like that. I don't know if that's a good argument, because, like, so there was a mistake?
No. That's what I said. The transfer of information always has within it errors, variations. In other words, if you would sit down and write 500 number sequence, you'd probably make a mistake.
How does that relate to a person being born?
Because when DNA, how does growth happen in the biological world? The DNA is the program. The DNA recreates another cell with the whole program of the structure of what it's supposed to look like, right? With your whole body, we can clone you from one DNA strand, right? So it's all programmed in beforehand. But it has to recreate itself into another cell. When it's being when it's creating another DNA strand and splitting off and going into another cell, its carbon copy is not exact.
So if that's the case, how can you not argue with the Torah when it was poured down from Mount Sinai and then carried from generation to generation? Now, here we're talking not even with science. Here we're talking with just people
who rewrite the Torah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the kind of thing. If I list 100 words, we might all take it away differently.
So there were mistakes. There were mistakes.
Starting in 2 minutes. 5 minutes.
There were mistakes. We have a few letters that are different from the Ashkenazi and Sephardic Torah. Aleph and Vavs that don't make a difference in understanding. And even then, Maimonides talks about Ben Asher, who lived a few hundred years before him, who realized that there were different Torahs with some mistakes. He took all the Torahs, and there's a halachic process where you take all the Torahs, you find the most common text, and then that becomes the definitive one. So even though Maimonides' 13 principles says the Torah we have is exactly the same as Moshe's Torah, it's not exactly.
That's amazing. These are very minute mistakes.
Yeah, but we have the whole process of how to, you know. So in any case, the problem is here, folks, I'm not even halfway through what we wanted to cover. The next weeks will be more personal, less theoretical. Okay, I promise. I was going to do balance today, but we got into the science stuff. We'll adjust the next couple of weeks. But next week, we're going to talk about divine providence. And here I'll ask you again to write down for next week if you feel that there are events in your life or in the world that are more than just circumstances, just coincidences that occur in your life or in the world. That would be the divine providence argument. The moral imperative argument is, if you believe in a sense of right and wrong, where does that come from? What is that based on? Do I act as a good person just because it makes me feel good or because I think it's right? And if it's more than just that, then why? And finally, the final category is the experiential truth, which is, have you ever had experiences in your life where you felt God's presence or felt the truth of God?
overwhelming. We didn't address it. If you'd like to look at some of them.
So I have here Lawrence Kellerman, Permission to Believe. You can look at that.
A lot of science.
Okay, some of the stuff, right? Some of this, some of the astrology. But he's got proofs, he's got philosophy as well. Zamir Cohen is the stuff I told you, like, that the rabbis knew that there were billions of stars and it took science 2,000 years to figure it out. The rabbis knew about Big Bang. He's got an entire book with pictures and fascinating articles about all these things that Torah knew that science subsequently discovered.
Pete, what number two? Will you want to enter number two?
The moral imperative is that if you believe there is right and wrong, where does that come from? Who's to say what's right and wrong? Who's to say we're right and the Palestinians are wrong? Or I'll give you the British soldier dilemma argument. It's 1935 and you're a British soldier stationed in India, British colony. And in your town you find out that there's a man who died. And his body is going to be burned the next day, and his wife is going to sit on the burial pyre and be burnt alive with his body, and according to Indian custom. Do you say that this is their custom, and they have their own values and culture, and so, you know, whose business is it ours to interfere? Or do you say, no, this is absolutely wrong, and I'm going to impose my values upon them and stop them from doing a custom which has been part of their culture and society for thousands of years because I'm right and they're wrong.
Can you explain that? The man dies for what reason?
In traditional Indian culture, when a husband died, the widow would get burnt alive with the body. They didn't bury, they burnt the body. And the woman would go on the body and be burnt with the body. Went on for thousands of years.
Doesn't happen.
No, no. Modern India, they have outlawed it. But
I don't know. I think the woman's okay with it. I mean, it's their fault.
Okay, so we'll discuss it next week. Okay, we're already getting the juices up. So Zamir Cohen presents articles on insights into the natural world, and Gerald Schroeder, Genesis and the Big Bang, is his reconciliation of science and Torah, the age of the universe. He also has an incredible explanation of God, why God would create a universe that has billions of galaxies, and each galaxy has billions of stars, if the world, the universe, was created for us. So here we are in this little speck of sand, or, you know, our little marble, you know, and you have the whole of North America, which is just one galaxy. Why is all this there if the world was created for the human beings, the Earth, and the Jewish people? So, Gerald Schroeder's got it. We don't have time to do it, but if you're interested, read ahead. Okay. See you all next week.